This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hello there and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, the best bits of today's show. It is a Friday, the 24th of May. Top stories this morning: Pakistan, Shahbaz Sharif, the Prime Minister in Abu Dhabi, meeting with the UAE President Sheikh Mohammed, and $10 billion worth of investment. That's what he's left with. We'll hear from him. And analysis from the economist Ed Bell. What else? ADNOC Drilling, raising 3 billion dirhams, selling shares to institutions. Yusuf Salem is the CFO. Brandy's been in conversation with him. Then we've got Gary Vaynerchuk, Gary V, the social media guru, 15 million followers on TikTok and lots more besides. He's got a new book. He was in the studio talking about it. And finally, holidays with Natalie Spree of August Leadership. All that to come. First up, though, top stories.
Nice weather out there. Roads looking pretty darn good this morning as well. Loads of comments coming through from you, which is nice. Good to have you giving us your feedback onto the show. And of course, some special guests to look forward to. Let's set the scene of what we've been discussing today. We start with high-level chats between the UAE and Pakistan. Richard Dean's been following this one for us.
Yeah, Shahbaz Sharif in Abu Dhabi yesterday, meeting with the President, His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, and many, many others as well. $10 billion agreed, but Shahbaz Sharif pains to point out, this is not aid, this is not handouts, this is investment in Pakistan, in productive sectors, in productive companies, in infrastructure. He gave a fascinating speech afterwards, not on a big stage, but in a small room to a handful of people. And I think he had some fascinating insights. Have a listen to this. This is how he started.
Gone are the days that I will go to a brotherly country with a begging bowl. I have broken that bowl. And I'm saying this here in my very dear brotherly country, Abu Dhabi. That bowl will lead us nowhere. When was the last time that a country prospered through aid, handout and bowls?
And he went on to talk about the historical relationship between the UAE and Pakistan, pointing out that in the early days of the UAE, it was Pakistan that was offering help to the UAE. We were reminiscing earlier, when Emirates launched in 85, they leased two planes, one Airbus, one Boeing. Who did they lease them from? PIA, Pakistan International Airlines. This is that historical perspective from Shahbaz Sharif.
There were days in the past when we used to, like brothers, invite them to King Edward Medical College, and our Air Force would train their pilots and so on and so forth. But today, I am going to ask and request my brother, President Mohammed bin Zayed, please, I will request you to offer your trainers to train our people today. That's what UAE has done.
So the $10 billion from the UAE going into Pakistan isn't handouts, but what is it? Here's Ed Bell, Senior Director of Market Economics at Emirates NBD.
The UAE has said it's going to invest $10 billion into Pakistan's economy following a visit of the country's president to Abu Dhabi. There are no specific sectors that have been announced for the targeted investments, but the funds would help to provide an anchor of external finance for Pakistan's economy, which in principle can help to stabilize the country's currency or its external debt sustainability. Pakistan agreed to an IMF program last year to borrow about $3 billion from the fund, which according to the IMF has been able to support the stabilization of the economy and provided some modest growth.
Those the thoughts of Ed Bell, Senior Director Market Economics at Emirates NBD.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
ADNOC, selling another chunk of shares in ADNOC Drilling, around 5.5% of the company. Very pleased to be joined on the line by Yusuf Salem, the Chief Financial Officer of ADNOC Drilling. Yusuf, good morning. It feels like about 5 minutes since we last spoke.
It's so good to be back so quickly. I was waiting for Q2, but glad this happens. I could be back with you.
This is true. We were just discussing ADNOC Drilling's Q1 numbers because it has been earnings season. With Yusuf, we are now looking at the $935 million that has been raised by ADNOC in a share sale of a few more shares of ADNOC Drilling. Not money that ADNOC Drilling gets itself. We'll get into that in a moment. But first, Yusuf, why is ADNOC doing this?
Yes, so obviously great, even though, as you said, ADNOC Drilling is not the one getting the money. There are great benefits for ADNOC Drilling from doing this. One is boosting the liquidity in our shares, which effectively yesterday we traded $44 million worth of shares in a single day, which are our highest ever since the IPO 2.5 years ago, which means that if you're an investor, if you're a large one or a small one, it's much easier now to come in, buy and sell ADNOC Drilling shares, which would ignite much more interest. Also, that would increase the free float, i.e. the number of shares which are available for the public to purchase, by more than 50% to 16.5%. Again, inviting many more people to the stock. And that's why you see the stock reacting very positively yesterday, closing up and trading to an inter-high, ever high of 4.6 dirhams, which is more than twice our kind of IPO price 2.5 years back. So you see how positively it was received by the market.
Increasing that free float could also get you entrance into the MSCI Emerging Market Capital Index. Tell me why that's a good thing.
That's a great thing. Effectively, the index is like a basket of stocks that a lot of the investors track and buy the basket in totality, which means that, for example, according to EFG estimates, there will be additional $333 million of inflows that will now come from investors because they're buying the overall basket, including now ADNOC Drilling. And these are major world indices, whether new ones we will enter, like MSCI, potentially as early as September, or existing ones we are part of, like FTSE, but now we'll end up with a higher weight in them because of the higher float, which means investors tracking this basket will buy even more of ADNOC Drilling.
And it will bring you a wider shareholding from outside of the UAE. What could that mean, though, for local investors?
Yes, it's a bigger opportunity for both. So obviously, we're waiting to see the settlement on 28 May to see the new shareholders in the book. But the way we would expect it to be is a very balanced mix of new investors coming in, both local professional investors from the UAE, as well as global investors. So basically, with more shares out there, it's an opportunity for both existing and new UAE and international investors to own more of the stocks. And off the back of our recent announcements of dividend increases, new $1.7 billion contract, 31% year-on-year growth, and new investments in AI and technology, this gives even more local and international investors the opportunity to participate in this story.
What do we know about the institutional investors who have taken up this offer? Are there any strategic investors in that?
So we expect this to be a mix of global and local financial investors, obviously because it's an ad hoc placement. You only get to know on it on 28th once we see these shareholders in our register. But we expect them to be blue chip names, institutions and professional investors. And again, this would further increase the diversity of the shareholder base. You see that also being very positively received by the analysts, with Morgan Stanley yesterday off the back of that, as well as the kind of the news from the company saying they could see the share price trading up potentially to 6 dirhams.
I understand what it means for your shareholders. Why is ADNOC itself doing it, though? Is it purely a capital raise?
So for us, the way we see it is we see it as a great support for ADNOC Drilling, because even after this transaction, ADNOC would still own 78.5% of ADNOC Drilling, would still be a very critical and the key strategic backer for ADNOC Drilling. However, it creates an opportunity for more and more investors, both locally and globally, to come in, sit alongside ADNOC and benefit from this massive growth story. To recap, we're basically pretty much the only kind of equity story that can offer you a 31% year-on-year growth while effectively giving you a stable dividend that's growing by at least 10% every year for the next 5 years. And ADNOC is allowing more people to sit alongside them in this journey.
Is this it for ADNOC ADNOC Drilling shares? Has there been any discussion about this potentially happening further?
So we understand ADNOC is now subject to a lockup of 6 months from here. Obviously, they continue to be a very strategic and by far the largest backer in our story. But again, for us, it's a positive when we see these shares come into the market, and that's why you see the market receiving it very, very positively and continuing to trade at all times high in both price, liquidity, target price, analysts. So it's positive all around.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Look, all eyes on ADNOC Drilling as the markets go live a little bit later this morning. Yusuf Salem is the Chief Financial Officer at ADNOC Drilling. Thank you for your time.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Talking social media now, Gary Vaynerchuk's with us in the studio. He is the author of 8 books, including his latest offering out this week, Day Trading Attention, How to Actually Build Brand and Sales in the New Social Media World. His 8th book, 5 of them New York Times bestsellers, 15 million followers on TikTok. I could go on. Morning, Gary.
Good morning.
8th book.
Yes.
Why didn't you stop after 7? Why does the world need another Gary V book?
I'm not sure if the world needs it. We're about to find out. I think the reason I wrote it is, for everybody who's listening, especially in a business framework, I think people are understanding that social media is changing and more important than ever. And what I mean for that, for the people that aren't really paying as close attention to it, changing in that it's very different than it was 15 years ago, the way it works. And more important than ever, I've been on this social media journey for that 15 years, and I can tell you over the last year, I run a very large advertising agency globally called VaynerMedia. Over the last 6 months, I wouldn't even say the year, this year, these first 5 months, I've had more significant conversations with Fortune 500 brands about them actually looking to allocate real money, be real serious, and want to be great at it. And so I decided to write a textbook, a real detailed manual of the current state of social media.
Let's talk about how the Gary V phenomenon began almost 20 years ago. For those who don't know you, I do, hashtag fanboy. But it started in the mid-2000s, and it was your family beverage business in the United States on the East Coast. And you started doing YouTube review videos.
Yes.
And that business on the back of those went from a $3 million business to a $60 million business, and that made your name. And then it all started from there. Just remind us of how that happened.
You know, it goes back even further than that. I was so early for that beverage business. I launched an e-commerce business in 1997, so 9 years prior to YouTube videos, and then obviously email marketing, and then Google AdWords, and then blogging. I was kind of following, it's basically the thesis of this book, where the attention was, and more importantly, the emerging attention, right? So there's always going to be a place where a platform, whether it's the invention of the radio, like we're doing right now, it didn't exist at some point. And once it existed and people put out content, both music and information, people started listening, then television, then internet. And so that's kind of how it all started. To your point, YouTube was a big turning point that also coincided with me jumping on Twitter and Facebook just as they launched. I became one of the first 50 people in the world to have 1 million followers on Twitter. That was obviously a big deal. And then I wrote the first business book. That was a phenomenon called Crush It that really talked about the opportunity of building brand on the internet, and that's how it all went.
Well, let's break down what this book is about. And as you say, it's a textbook. It's very heavy on examples and diagrams and how-to graphs. You talk about understanding attention, and you talk about understanding underpriced attention.
Yes.
What's underpriced attention?
Like I just referred to, underpriced attention is TikTok 4 years ago, right? 4 years ago, I'm making videos all over the internet saying, please start posting on TikTok. Please start posting on TikTok. Underpriced attention may be Spotify ads right now. It may be, by the way, it may be traditional mediums too. So one of the interesting parts about traditional underpriced attention is sometimes a traditional platform like outdoor billboards or a television commercial or a newspaper ad can actually go from being very overpriced for a period of time to actually becoming underpriced because media dollars are shifting. And so traditional channels may become underpriced. Email marketing, Google AdWords, they were incredibly underpriced in the 90s and early 2000s. Today, Google AdWords are appropriately priced or potentially overpriced because there's so much being thrown in there, but there's only so much attention on the other side with AI, ChatGPT, and things of that nature. So it's a concept of where there's market inefficiency of people and companies overspending somewhere and underspending somewhere, thus rendering things overpriced and underpriced.
Okay, you've mentioned the Spotify ads there, and I know you say that day trading is all about the now and not predicting where we're going, but what do you think, maybe like the Spotify ads, are the next areas of underpriced attention?
It's. I appreciate the way you framed it. I've had a nice long career at this point. I get a lot of credit for like seeing around corners and predicting the future. And the truth is, that has not been what I've done in my career. What I've done is I am hyper obsessed with today, and I think the world of business and marketing is obsessed with tomorrow, AI, metaverse, and overly romantic about yesterday. Let's keep making TV commercials even though no one watches them, and so. You know, look, I think there's clearly things in the air. I do follow technology very heavily. Let me say something that I will be proud that I've said so I can recall it 5 years from now, a clip from this show. AI is going to decimate search engines. I mean, do you know how much money is being spent on Google AdWords? It's a profound amount, hundreds of billions, like a profound. That could be wrong, but it's tens of billions for sure. The human behavior of people searching on search engines with these AI mechanisms is gonna change dramatically. Basically, the next generation of kids, Gen Alpha, is gonna look at all of us using Google to look up stuff the way we look at people using the encyclopedia. So that's clearly going to be underpriced at some point. It's still so early that it's not there yet, and I don't even know how to run ads yet on a ChatGPT. We don't have those products yet, but it's very clear to me that the search money is gonna be up in for grabs over the next decade.
And yet you've written a book. It's sitting in front of you. It's hardcover.
Yes.
It's printed.
Yes.
The writing process, the editing process, the printing process, the shipping process, all takes time.
Yes.
For someone who's obsessed with now, how long do you think that book is going to be relevant?
It's less relevant today than it was yesterday. What's amazing about this book for me is I think about value very simply. This book is $28. Do I believe that people over the next 3 years will get $28 worth of value? Yes, I do. But to your point, it's a tremendous call out. What my publisher hates the way I write books. This is real. I like to write books that are incredibly timely and have extraordinary value, actionable, right? So many people listening right now have read many business books, and they're great because they're philosophical and they're tried and true human behaviors. However, I find that books are an incredible way that people learn. Ironically, I'm not one of those people. I do much better with audio and visual, but book form is something that works for a lot of people. But I tend to write books that have a shelf life. And so for me, the way I wrote this and based on what my experience is, I think over the next 3 to 4 years, it has higher value. But the reason I wrote this book, actually, I misspoke earlier of why I wrote it. I wrote a book 10 years ago called Jab, 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 Right Hook that was a smash hit. I still get emails from people that bought it like a month ago and they're like, Gary, love Jab, Jab. I'm like, what? It is so not. And so this was actually, this book, Day Trading Attention, its original title was Jab, 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 Left Hook. I adjusted it once I realized I was going a little bit in a different direction, but that's right.
Look, we're a business show, mm-hmm. and this is a business city. And one of the things that really struck me about your new book is the fact that you don't seem to be a massive fan of what's happening in boardrooms when it comes to marketing decisions. You don't really like the research. You don't like a lot of the proxy studies. You don't like the corporate decisions. Explain why not.
Because they're not business.
More?
Please. I love business so much, and I love marketing so much, that I'm devastated what Fortune 5000 marketing looks like. So for context, the 5,000 biggest companies in the world are probably the 5,000 worst marketing companies in the world. And for every, back to your point of who listens to this show, every board member of a meaningful company right now just smiled or said yes listening to this, because what I can promise you, sitting in these boardrooms myself, being in meetings with the biggest hedge funds and private equity firms and CEOs in the world, all of them are struggling with justifying the ROI of marketing, because marketing in 2024 has become incredibly academic and reliant on fake reports.
You say that they're boardroom centric, not consumer centric. What do you mean?
So just explain to everybody how it really works under the hood. If you're Coca-Cola, the way you're measuring your marketing is by a bunch of reports that are grounded in falsities. What happened 30 years ago in Madison Avenue Don Draper marketing was we separated media and creative. I don't think people know this, but most big companies, BMW, Mercedes-Benz, they have one agency that runs the media and a separate one that runs the creative. What that creates is no accountability. And so what we did over the last 30 years is create a bunch of fake reports to justify the spend. And so what everybody in the game really knows on the inside, this is the reason you've probably seen these headlines, you've probably read some of them on this great show, CMOs only last for 18 months in most of these big companies. They get blown out all the time because they really are dancing instead of actually driving results. This all lends itself to why big companies continue to underinvest where the attention is, social media, and they continue to overinvest in all sorts of silly things like traditional digital banner ads and a bunch of other things.
But even on social media, you're saying that these big well-known brands should throw out things like the brand fonts that they use, their recognizability.
Well, you know, what I'm fine with, I love where you're going with this. So what you're referring to is being on brand. I'm not saying that BMW should not use their fonts. I'm just saying that they're allowed to use other fonts in an individual social media post that isn't the core fonts, right? You cannot imagine what actually happens in these rooms. Again, the biggest companies in the world will sit and debate for an hour an Instagram post that hardly anybody even sees if it's not good. And they'll decide that they can't use a font or a color because it's not on brand, but no consumer actually thinks that way. So I'm not telling them to change their logo or make it look different. I'm saying that they can do and instead of or.
Let's talk about your other book that you've got with you.
Yes.
It's a kid's book called Meet Me in the Middle.
Thank you.
I want to, so a three-part question on children. Ooh. One is, tell us about the book and why you wrote it. The second one is, what about the ethics of the social media playbook in day trading attention? I've no doubt it works, but I've got teenage kids and I worry about their exposure on social media. And the third part is, you as a family man, you famously don't share your family on social media. So you're clearly very attuned to this. Pull those threads together.
Let's pick number two real fast. This will help everybody listening. I want everyone to really pay attention. If you are worried as a parent about your children on social media, take them off of social media. I beg and plead for this generation to finally start parenting. I think we have conformed into trying to be too much of our kids' friends. If you're genuinely concerned, if you're not genuinely concerned and it's a conversation piece, then that's fine. But if you're genuinely concerned for your children about anything, I would highly recommend to step up and be a parent. So that's what I think about that. Number three, I'll go there. I was genuinely concerned that I didn't think it was a good idea ever in my life to share my private life with the world, because whatever you share with the world is theirs. And my private life and my family life is the most important thing to me in the world. It didn't even, and I, as you know, and I appreciate your words earlier, I never did. 2006, when this was all nirvana and nobody was thinking about the downside, it was intuitive to me that that's not something I needed to give the world. And so I'm very happy I've done that, and so that's been the case. And then number one, the kids book's really fun for me. 4 years ago, I started this intellectual property. Think of it as Sesame Street meets Pokemon. So it's very focused. The book's called Meet Me in the Middle, and it's a story of Patient and Eager Eagle. Both are great traits, in my opinion. Being eager is a wonderful thing, being patient a wonderful thing. But if you do too much of it, being too patient means you're complacent. Being too eager, you could be sloppy. And so what's really fun about this book is it really teaches people to find the middle. And in general, I think on most wonderful human traits, people take them too far and then they get to a bad version of it. And then more importantly, I just think society, global politics and business and life, I think we've just gotten too far to the edges. I think we live in a generation now where the tail is wagging the dog. And I implore everyone to find the middle. As a matter of fact, very subtly in my other book, Day Trading Attention, I picked the color purple for my cover as a little wink to myself about the middle. As some may know that are listening, America has a very red and blue society. And I feel like if it got to the middle and became purple, we'd be in a better place. And so meet me in the middle.
Why, though, write about something completely different for the kids? You're talking about emotional intelligence there. Surely these are the guys who are going to be the content creators. Why not content creation for kids?
You know, my last book that only came out a couple of years ago was called 12 and a Half, the 13 Ingredients of Emotional Intelligence. I'm, you know, again, I think going back to it, I'm not against or for kids doing content creation. I think that's a very personal decision for families. Mozart was a kid that did content, right? So I think if, you know, telling parents what they should or shouldn't do is not what I'm interested in. I'm saying parenting should be talked about in modern times. But on an individual level, the last thing I would want to get into is tell somebody what they should do. And so there may be a time where I write a book for content creation strategies for the younger set. Gen Alpha is actually very interesting. I'm already kind of studying it, but just timing.
Lastly, please, on that, what does AI and ChatGPT mean for all of this? You've written these books, but you could have had someone else write them for them with just a prompt.
Yeah, I think to your point, great call out. You know, let me just bring as much value to this audience as possible. Please, please, please do not put your head in the sand like an ostrich to AI. AI is one of the most profound technologies in the history of mankind. I don't even think the best thinkers, you know, can really understand how mass. I mean, I'm sure you've covered this. You've seen the quotes. Some of the most powerful, greatest thinkers of modern technology are petrified. And that's just because they're trying to be thoughtful. But I think AI is going to change our world. And you're right. I mean, I'm mapping all of the information I've put out on the internet for the last 25 years. A lot of things are going to be able to be done in a press of a button, which is game changing.
Gary, we're going to have to leave it there out of time. Fascinating insights. Appreciate it. The book is called Day Trading Attention. It is out now. $28, says Gary. I bought the Audible version last night for $10. It was
very
cheaper.
Nice.
I don't get the graphs that Brandy's enjoyed, but I enjoyed the book. Gary Vaynerchuk, thank you.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Size Business Breakfast.
Quiet vacationing. What is it? Well, apparently millennials are doing it, and they're doing a lot of it at the moment, rather than asking their boss for a bit of paid time off, or PTO. Loads of articles, loads of chat, loads of social media activity on this one at the moment. So let's set the scene. Paid days off from work aren't a guarantee, especially for Americans, where paid holiday is... Well, it's not as we know it, Jim. But even when they do get them, they're leaving them on the table. A majority, 78% of US workers, say they don't take all their PTO days. And it's highest among Gen Z workers and millennials, according to this new Harris Poll survey of American workers. Right, have we got to this point and what can be done about it? A question I'm going to put to the partner of August Leadership, Natalie Spree, who's been kind enough to join us live in studio. Nat, good to see you as always.
Lovely to see you.
So how have we got to this point? How did all this chat start?
Actually, I've been following it on X, formerly known as Twitter, this week. There was a picture of a bunch of assumed millennials in a park in Austin on a nice sunny Tuesday afternoon, and people commenting about, you know, I'm going to buy short shares in this, you know, the company that they work for. You know, people aren't working. It's quite generational. It seems to be slightly older generations that are commenting on this. And then there was another video with a couple of program managers in the US doing their work from a swimming pool. And so there's been a lot of chatter about it, a lot of reposting and commenting. As you say, it's targeted more at millennials and Gen Z. A lot of the kind of defense of this article, there is a lot of tongue in cheeks, a lot of humor around it also, by the way. I think that's why things have gone viral, saying that the author of this current piece that we're talking about now is the girl that, you know, reminded the teacher that they hadn't set homework and, you know, leave us alone, or how much can we pay you to remove this article? Like, don't ruin our fun. I think most of it is tongue in cheek, but there is an undertone that this is going on. And so this quiet
vacationing.
I think for Brits, we'd call it skiving or bunking off, right? Yeah, I mean, there's a thing about pay time off. Obviously, in the US, as you said, they tend to get much less allowance than us. So it might be quite a regional thing. My opinion is that if you're taking time off, it should be time off. You really need to recharge and have your vacation time, especially if you only have 2 weeks. It's a tough one.
What about, I mean, if the work is getting done, does it matter where you're doing the work? I mean, the whole point of remote working is, you know, there's no definition of what remote means. Is there this idea that if you're not at your kitchen table or you're not at your home office, then you're not really working? It's a moot question to ask on a Friday morning when more and more people are choosing to work from home on Fridays as well. But if you're getting the work done, if you're getting the results, does it matter?
It shouldn't matter. I think it depends a lot on your CEO or leadership team, founding team, you know, the culture of the business as well. A lot more are in person. There are some businesses here that very quickly return to 5 days a week in the office. Mm-hmm. Fridays are definitely busier here. I think in Dubai, for sure, there's a lot more, you know, they like to have FaceTime. There are a lot of businesses that might be more micromanaging. They have less trust in their employees. They don't perhaps measure or see the productivity and output and measure somebody's, you know, performance in that way. I'm a great believer in empowering people and for them to be diligent and honest and hardworking. But it's quite difficult for some to stomach that. And they do think that if you aren't full time at your laptop, you're shirking off. And some people just work better flexibly. You know, you might find that they're not online at 3 p.m. in the afternoon, but they're going to be working till midnight and make sure, as you said, that the work is done. So it comes down to the culture of the company. And I think you need to align as an individual. If that's how you work, but the company that you're working for has a very different culture and a mindset towards that, perhaps you need to consider where you belong.
So this, the whole concept of work from home needs buy-in from both sides in order to make that flexibility work. And yeah, there might be those saying, oh, I'll work from home because I'm just going to have a long weekend, and therefore, hence the quiet vacationing accusations as well.
Exactly. Setting expectations clearly, maybe having a few guidelines around it. For example, for myself, you know, saying somebody's working remotely for up to 4 weeks. And a lot of businesses do that now. They'll give you, especially here where the summers are hot. But the understanding is the agreements, you know, kind of that psychological contract, is that you are working the same hours that you would normally do and you're fully available in that time. But you just happen to be doing it from a villa in Tuscany. You know, I did that myself a couple of years ago. But, you know, keeping to some quite stringent guidelines like that. But others and certain jobs that you do might require you to not be present at certain hours and therefore you can work later.
Let's talk PTO, because this is a new one to me. I mean, surely that's just, well, certainly for full-time employees, it's holiday, isn't it?
Yeah, it is your holiday allowance. That's it, really, in the nutshell. I don't think there's any other way of framing it.
And do policies need to change there when it comes to PTO? You mentioned America, and they have a very different approach, don't they?
I think the policies are set, but how they're interpreted by certain companies, as I was saying, you know, if somebody's taking paid time off, you should leave them alone. You shouldn't be forcing them to work. You should allow them to have their vacation time. It's important for them to do so and have rest and recuperation.
What about how? What's the solution here? I mean, some companies are trying to micromanage. Some companies are suggesting, you know, they put spyware into computers, etc., to work out who's working, when you log on, when you don't log on, etc. What's the sweet spot here?
I'm very against that micromanaging kind of spyware. There are a lot of businesses. I was looking at it last night, actually, before I came on. There are a lot of businesses and softwares that you can add and track your employees every keystroke. I think that's a bridge too far. You need to build a culture of trust and diligence and hard work and make sure you're employing people like that. There's always going to be a few outliers. I think on the whole, most people are very diligent and hardworking. But the outliers can sometimes ruin it for everybody, where it causes a little bit of mistrust. So looking at the business and the leadership team, you need to set up a framework where you can be sure of where the productivity is and where it isn't and identify it, rather than creating micromanaging rules that damage everybody for one person kind of messing up and being on West Beach on a Wednesday afternoon when they should be working.
I've saved it so we've got 2 minutes to talk about this one, because I know I'm going to get it nailed by the fact that we are going to pick on the millennials. Are we picking on the millennials here? I mean, the numbers are stacking up here. It shows that millennials are the most likely to what we call quiet vacation. Does that come as a surprise to us?
I don't think it's a surprise. I think maybe Gen Z is more than millennials as well. Yeah. I hate to really pigeonhole people into generations. But the way that culture has changed, especially since COVID, which seems like quite a lifetime ago now, but just there's different expectations. I mean, look, at our kids are the same age, right? And I know that none of them want to be working. They think it's absolutely insane to think of working a 9-to-6 job Monday to Friday. Expectations have changed, hence hits the generations. But I do know other people that are Gen X. I don't know about anything older than that in my current workplace, but that also still have that flexibility. But I think, say, the diligence and hard work, which can come at any age, I think when you're, you know, hiring people into a company, it's making sure that their values align with your own. And for people that are looking for jobs as well, be open and honest about what you're looking for. If you're looking for that flexibility, tell your company, because you're just going to butt heads continuously otherwise, or get fired.
Yeah, try and avoid that at the weekends.
Yeah.
Not ideal, that's exactly. For sure, especially going into the summer. Natalie, thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure, as always.
Really appreciate it. Thanks for coming in and sharing your thoughts. Natalie Spree, partner at August Leadership, joining us live here in studio on the subject of quiet vacationing. Is that something that you do? We'd love to hear from you.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.